Sometimes writing a biography isn't just about getting the facts right. It can be a matter of life or death. Robert Sebag is the author of the book Loaded, A Misadventure on the Marijuana Trail. It's the biography of a drug smuggler named Alan Long. Anne Strainchamp sat down with Robert to talk about the book. A week later, she spoke with Alan. The two men have known each other for years, but it seems they aren't always on the same page about one important thing, their relationship with each other.
Robert Sebag made his name as a journalist with his book Snowblind. It's the story of the rise and fall of a cocaine smuggler, and it was one of the big hot books of the late 70s. Robert got a lot of strange offers in the wake of the book, and one of them was from a man named Alan Long.
In 1978, I was living in New York, and that was sort of at the peak of my quote-unquote career as a smuggler, and I read a book by Robert Sebag called Snowblind. And that was the funniest, best book about the drug culture that I'd ever read. And being someone who sort of charges ahead despite the obstacles, I contacted Robert Sebag personally. I hunted him down and got him on the phone, and I said, I would like to buy the motion picture rights to your book. And he said, who are you? I said, oh, I'm a would-be film producer who has $100,000 that I'm ready to hand you a check for right now for the motion picture rights to your book. And he was at my house shortly thereafter. We talked for a while, and unfortunately for me and perhaps for the project, a real producer in Hollywood purchased the rights to the book.
When did you ask him to write your story?
Well, it occurred to Bob after about 2 hours of our negotiating back and forth with his agent in Hollywood and this other producer, and I lost out on the bidding for the motion picture rights to Snowblind. That's when he looked at me and he said, where did you get all this money? And I said, oh, I'm a pot smuggler.
In fact, Alan was what you could call one of the original pot smugglers, a kind of 1960s Horatio Alger figure who'd staked it all on a dope-induced dream and hit it big. Robert Sebag.
Like many guys of his generation and his ilk, you know, they started out as pot smokers long before they were criminals. And his dream was to go to Colombia and bring back what at the time was the best pot available, which was Santa Marta Gold. And it was hard to come by here in the States. And he was going to bring it back in quantity. And he and his colleagues grabbed themselves a DC-3, this old rickety airplane. They got a professional pilot. They flew to Colombia and brought back, I guess, you know, maybe the first trip was 4,500 pounds or something like that. Well, that escapade, and it was a kind of adventure.
I mean, you make it sound easy. It can't have been easy to somehow get a DC-3 and fly to the mountains of Colombia.
And before that, they had to go down and actually, like, find people to sell them marijuana at that quantity.
Yeah, and it's not like there was, you know, an airstrip. And,
no,
you know,
all of that stuff.
That
no, it was just,
here.
I mean, that's what's so surprising about a lot of, but it went on, I mean, on the Guajira in Colombia, the Badlands in the northeast coast of Colombia. It was like the Berlin airlift. I mean, there were planes and boats and going in and out. It was the gold rush. You know, in the course of 4 years, he smuggled 972,000 pounds of marijuana.
Now, Robert had already written one story about a drug smuggler, and he wasn't necessarily interested in writing another. But Alan Long wasn't just another dope smuggler. His adventures had a kind of gonzo, slapstick looniness to them. Take, for instance, the story of one of his first trips to Colombia.
They hit a runway that was destroyed by rain. It was nothing but mud. This airstrip, this dirt strip that was bad enough to begin with, became impossible, almost impossible to land on. They did land the plane because the pilot was as good as he was. You know, they came in with an empty plane. They managed to actually not die when they landed the plane. And Alan Long gets off, and he decides he wants to load it with 4,800 pounds of pot to take home. And he and the pilot, of course, get into an argument about. The pilot says to him, there's no way we're going to get off this runway with anything on this. We're lucky to get off at all. But anyway, Alan prevailed, and they waited a little while for the strip to dry, and they took off. But what they did is they hit palm trees as they're flying back to the United States with a palm tree hanging from the engine and fuel leaking all. But when you take off with 4,800 pounds in a DC-3 off an airstrip in Colombia, it takes you about 3 hours to get more than 50 feet off the water. I mean, these guys, they have to burn off so much fuel before they gain altitude. They get to Florida, and there they cross at West Palm Beach, ignoring all the radio signals for them to turn on their transponder and identify themselves. And going up through Central Florida, they're traveling slower than the traffic on the highway below them. And on one of these occasions, they hit a thunderstorm, and they had to circumnavigate the storm. And in order to do so, they had to go over MacDill Air Force Base. So the Air Force scrambled fighter jets to go up and the jets couldn't slow down enough to keep pace with the DC-3. It was going so slow. But what happened is the pilot, the radar officer in back is looking over and they're trying to find out what's going on in this DC-3. And there's Alan Long, who happened to be flying left seat at the time. You know, he's got an oxygen hose in one side of his mouth, a joint hanging out of the other side. He's got a Heineken in his lap and he's holding up the microphone, telling them the radio's busted. And they're listening to the transmission that the Air Force is having on the other side. And they're just saying, it just looks like a bunch of smugglers to us and this isn't our business and we're leaving. And the jets are off.
So this was all too good to resist, and Robert Sebag agreed to write Alan Long's story. This was the book that became Loaded. Robert was kind of bemused by Alan at first, but the relationship between a biographer or a journalist and his subject is a complicated thing, and the two men don't always describe it the same way.
I took Bob to Columbia, to the landing strip where I crashed the airplane in the biggest airplane crash in the book. There are several. And we were standing there. Now, Bob had known me for over a dozen years by then. And we were standing there on the runway, and I was explaining to him the plane was headed that way, and, here's the ocean, and there's the jungle, and here I'm trying to describe the scene for him. And a little Indian man came out of the woods or out of the bush, and he walked up to us, he looked me up and down, and he went, "Alan, gracias para mi casa, Alan." And Bob said, "What's he saying?" I said, "He's thanking me for his house. I don't know why." And the man motioned for us to follow him. We walked through the bush. We went about 300 yards into the jungle, and there was a small clearing with a little Indian village there, which I recalled then from years and years before. And there in the middle of the village was about a 15-foot-long section of the fuselage of my cargo plane with the doors and the windows and everything still in it. They had cut that out of the plane that crashed and carried it somehow to the village. This little man who had greeted us was the chief, and that was his house. Sometime after that, Bob and I were walking back and getting in the airplane. And he looked at me and he said, "So you really did this? All this stuff you've told me all these years was true?" And I looked at Bob and I said, "I can't believe you didn't believe me."
Of course, as a good journalist, Robert Sebag would never take anything Alan Long told him at face value. So he checked every fact, every story that he could, which meant hunting down other sources at, you would assume, some personal risk. Given the subject matter and the kind of people you're talking about, I mean, this is the world of drug smugglers. Mm-hmm. These are people who kill. Weren't you ever worried that if he didn't like what you wrote, you'd find yourself floating face down in a river?
Well, Alan Long is not a killer. I mean, one of the reasons he didn't last in the business is because he refused to get violent. I mean, that's what happened. The business was taken over by violent criminals. He woke up one day and found out he wasn't who he wanted to be, and he got out of the business.
You never felt at risk while you were working on the book?
I did feel a little bit at risk when I was dealing with some of the Cubans in Miami. But I trusted him not to put me into a situation. He didn't walk me in to some guy's house and surprise them with, the information that this is a reporter and he's writing about us. He would have this conversation with them before he would introduce me to them. I mean, he would ask them if they were willing to cooperate.
So Robert decided to trust Alan to protect him while he researched his story. But Alan was maybe a little disingenuous about the risks.
Bob didn't realize how much in danger he might be. I mean, we were in Colombia, and he was meeting all these people. You have to understand that this part of Colombia, which is called the Guajira, is just like Dodge City and Tombstone. I mean, to this day, there are areas where all men carry guns out in the open. They carry them in their Western-style holsters with pearl-handled revolvers. Some guys carry two. And they'll shoot each other at the drop of a hat. Bob is quite a gutsy individual himself. I don't think he was really ever scared until one day when we were visiting a little house in a town called Rio Hacha, which was the smuggling Mecca. And we were visiting the commandant. He was part of my operation, the guy who ran the local military group. And he also was the man who issued all the gun licenses. And as a joke, some of his friends came in the door with all their guns out. They'd heard that we were there. And they wanted to give Bob a taste of the real Guajira. And the last thing I saw of Bob as those guys came through the door were his heels as he went through the back door and out in the backyard of the guy's house.
The biggest violation of trust wasn't a game, though. See, Robert took the writing project in the first place because Alan had assured him that he was out of the business, that his smuggling days were over. Then halfway through the writing process, Alan Long disappeared. Turns out he had been smuggling drugs the whole time, and now the feds were on his tail. Alan went underground. He took his fake passport and his millions, and for 8 years he lived the high life on yachts and in luxury hotels around the Caribbean. He lost contact with his family and friends, with pretty much everyone in his life except, curiously, Robert Sebag, the biographer he had lied to. Robert used to get phone calls in the middle of the night. It would be Alan, semi-incoherent and high on cocaine. He didn't seem to want anything, and Robert figured their association was pretty much dead anyway. But then federal agents began calling, too.
The second phone call that I received from the federal government, and that was at a point at which I hadn't seen Alan Long for a couple of years, I think. And of course, I had always had questions as to how my name came up in that investigation. You know, why would my name come up with his? I don't know how they associated me with him. Well, I learned a lot in this particular phone call. The reason my name kept coming up in the Alan Long investigation is that when he applied for a passport under one of his phony identifications, he had used me, the only legitimate person he knew. He used me as a reference. He had put my name down, so that's why they called me when they were looking for him.
But you know what that story says is that you had meaning in Alan Long's life. I mean, you had become, whether you wanted to be a character in his life or not, an important person to him.
I don't think there's any question about that. And it's interesting. I really do believe that, you know, those phone calls that I would get from hotel rooms in the middle of the night were usually when there was somebody else in the room with him. He was showing off. And I became important in his life because I was the guy who had written a book about a smuggler, and Alan probably wanted to let them know that he was important enough to have me writing a book about him or writing a movie about him or thinking about doing so.
During those years when you were a fugitive,
yes,
you stayed in touch with Robert. I imagine he's one of the few people, I don't know, not underground, who you stayed in touch with. Why did you?
Because I liked him very much. Bob was a good friend.
Robert remembers that a lot of the calls came in the middle of the night. What was going on for you?
When I talked to Bob, it was sometimes because Bob was one of the few people I could actually talk to who knew me well enough to know who I really was, you know. To most people who were my friends, quote unquote, in those days, I guess I was more of a, I don't know, maybe I was more of sort of a mythical creature in their minds than a reality. And talking to Bob was a reality check. Also, he's a journalist, you know. He could keep a confidence.
There's something so sad and telling about those middle-of-the-night phone calls. You can picture Alan trying to hold on to something solid in his life, knowing that the only person he can trust is a man who is not really his friend. When he called at 2 in the morning, did he ever hear Bob pick up a notebook and begin to take notes? And on Robert's side, why exactly did he continue to take Alan's phone calls? I mean, did he feel a moral obligation to be there for the guy he'd had some adventures with? Or was he just covering his bases on the off chance that there might be a book in this after all? What's your relationship with Alan Long like today? Do you still have one?
Oh, yeah. We do. It's interesting because you would think that a certain distance would grow up after the job is done. But the fact is that the promotional responsibilities kind of pull you together in a way. You know, he and I are constantly being asked to go out and do something. It's often together. He and I are leaving for London in February to promote the British edition of the book.
Are you friends?
Not so much anymore. I mean, I think that, you know, it's a very fine line that one has to walk. You have to maintain the kind of distance. I can't write about people I know. I mean, I can't write about my friends. I can't, you know, I doubt that when this all shakes down, that Alan and I will see each other much more than ever, you know. I mean, we're pals and, you know, we'll call each other at Christmas and, you know, that kind of thing.
Are you and Robert still in contact with each other?
Every day. I talked to him this morning. We're heading for London on Saturday to do a European promotional tour for the book.
When the promotion stuff for the book is done, what do you think your relationship will be like? Are you guys going to be friends?
We'll be friends, good friends for life. We are good friends for life. Isn't that great?
Alan Long got tired of living a lie and turned himself in. He forfeited all his drug wealth and served a 5-year prison sentence for passport fraud and marijuana trafficking. He now lives in Virginia with his wife and two children. Robert Sebag is the author of Loaded, A Misadventure on the Marijuana Trail, a biography of Allen's days as a drug smuggler. And Strange Hemp spoke with Robert Sebag and, a week later, with Alan Long.